Dr. William Sook, also known as Bill Sook, the director of the Superfund Research Program and the Hazardous Substances Research Branch at the NIEHS Division of Extramural Research and Training, also known as DIRT. Dr. Sook has served as director of the SRP since its inception in 1986. He received his PhD in microbiology from the George Washington University Medical School and his master's in public health and health policy from the School of Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Bill, I will now turn it over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Heather. I appreciate it. good afternoon, all. So I'm going to do the advanced slide. Okay. So I want to thank you all. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the program and how we have been involved in remediation, specifically bioremediation research, for quite a while. So the NIEHS Superfund Research Program was formed in 1986 under the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, otherwise known as SARA. And we are a part of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which is an institute of the National Institutes of Health. Okay. The SRP centers take a unique team science approach. The centers bring together diverse disciplines, health researchers, engineers, biologists, ecologists, earth scientists, social scientists, etc. The researchers aim to understand and reduce exposure to potentially harmful contaminants and thereby improve health. SRP grantees work closely with industry, government, tribal, and business partners to deliver practical solutions. This is a solution-oriented problem-solving program. To understand the scope of the Superfund Research Program, I thought I would show you our mandates. Here is a photograph of the paper copy on your left there. The entire authorization of this program is in a page and a half. And as you can see, we have four broad mandates that include health effects, include health effects and new methods for assessing risk, detection technologies, as well as remediation technologies. Hence, bioremediation falls squarely under our fourth mandate, focused on methods to reduce the amount and or toxicity of hazardous substances. Mandate number four is unique to NIH and NIEHS and requires us to develop and use advanced technologies to reduce exposures and therefore the burden of disease. Bioremediation refers to the use of biota, bacteria, algae, fungi, plants, etc., to reduce or detoxify hazardous substances in the environment. Bioremediation is a cost-effective, low-energy, intensive remedy that has contributed to closure and delisting of Superfund, RCRA sites, and other sites impacted by hazardous substances. While bioremediation has many advantages, there are some limitations to bioremediation. In many cases, it is not a rapid cleanup. Because you are dealing with natural systems there are many unknowns, such as unintended byproduct formation or uptake into the food chain. It can be rather slow at times, therefore, but like any in situ remedy, it requires careful site analysis in advance and during remediation efforts. Also, because this is a science and technology-driven process, there are opportunities for continued research to optimize the process, therefore speeding it up and making it more efficient. I'd like to take a moment to share with you the timeline highlighting the investment that our program has made in bioremediation. The first awards were made in 1987, and by the following year, a bioremediation project was initiated at the University of Washington, focusing on phytoremediation. Shortly thereafter, SRP sponsored a pivotal meeting on bioremediation in 1990. It was held at Utah State University. And starting in early 2000, we began funding small businesses, including those developing tools that were based on bioremediation, showing the commercialization potential of this form of cleanup. The Superfund Research Program highly regards training, and in 2009, the SRP became the sponsor of the Phyto Scholars, a training opportunity of global scholars involved with the International Phytotechnology Society. SRP has also encouraged looking ahead, and that has evidence, and that was evidenced by a 2010 meeting on the microbiome here at NIEHS, which built on many techniques and expertise of our bioremediation scientists, such as Dr. TG, who will be one of our speakers today. Fast forward today, we have about 22 projects with a bioremediation component. Okay, cool. As a basic research program, SRP grantees have used mechanistic science as a foundation to develop solutions. Now in our 33rd year, we are able to see the impact SRP-funded bioremediation research has had over the years. SRP has invested in some of the pioneering work in bioremediation, such as developing bioengineered plant bacterial systems capable of extracting and degrading chlorinated compounds. SRP has also excelled in developing engineered amendments to enhance bioremediation and utilizing isotopes and omics to monitor the progress of bioremediation. These early examples demonstrate that innovative research approaches are key to advancing bioremediation and have both influenced remedy selection at sites as well as led to small business spin-offs and cost savings at real sites. I focus you to the reference that is listed here on the slide. I suggest that you might want to look at it. It shows the cost effectiveness and essentially the return on investment of the remediation technologies that this program has advanced over the years. Next, I will tell you about a few of these examples. Researchers led by Milk Gordon and Lee Newman at the University of Rochester's SRP Center pioneered the use of hybrid poplar trees to remove TCE and other chlorinated contaminants from groundwater. The research from this project was the first to show conclusively that plants themselves, not just microorganisms associated with the plants, are capable of degrading toxic compounds. With SRP funding, the researchers demonstrated that hybrid poplars, could take up and degrade TCE under greenhouse and laboratory conditions. They then demonstrated the poplars' potential for in situ remediation of TCE in the field. Results from a controlled field study showed that trees removed more than 99% of TCE present in groundwater and that less than 9% of the TCE transpired from the trees to the atmosphere. The phytoremediation system has been installed as part of a remediation plan as part of remediation plans for cleanup of hazardous waste sites, including the Undersea Naval Warfare Center. They applied hybrid poplars to the site, which saved an estimated $8.5 million to $10.5 million compared with the traditional methods. Building off the original SRP-funded research to clean up TCE with hybrid poplar trees, the U.S. EPA used hybrid poplar trees at the Argonne National Laboratory in Batavia, Illinois, saving an estimated $2.4 million. Therefore, according to estimates by the DOD Environmental Security Technology Certification Program, as many as 1,000 DOD cleanup sites worldwide could utilize this this technology, saving hundreds of millions of dollars. Not bad, huh? Okay. So with SRP funding, Kate Scow at UC Davis and her team isolated the PM1 bacterial strain, which can completely degrade MTBE. She also discovered that it often occurs naturally, and shifting aquifer geochemistry could stimulate its activity to break down MTBE. Excuse me. In collaboration with Haley and Aldridge, Inc., an engineering and environmental science consulting firm, the researchers applied the technology at the North Hollywood Tesoro Petroleum Site in California. Before the treatment, MTBE concentrations were more than 1,000 parts per billion in the groundwater. The plume was migrating towards and potentially threatening municipal supply wells. The team identified the presence of PM1 and set up a self-seeded field-scale bioreactor for treating the MTBE-affected groundwater. Bioremediation decreased groundwater MTBE at North Hollywood from more than 10,000 parts per billion to less than 1 part per billion in 3 years. A significant unanticipated outcome was the regulatory permission to return the water treated through this bioremediation process back into the California drinking water aquifer. In addition to treating the water more quickly and reaching levels that allowed for reuse, the technology also resulted in 14 million to 21 million dollars in cost savings because it eliminated the need to drill 2 to 3 replacement wells at a site, which would have cost approximately $7 million each. Another project I would like to feature is the work of Jerry Schnorr, the work that Jerry Schnorr is doing, understanding how plants and associated microbes degrade PCBs. He has applied functional genomics to identify enzymes responsible for PCB degradation in soil. Recently, he has initiated field-scale use of poplar trees in a PCB-contaminated lagoon in Alta Vista, Virginia. His work with Alta Vista and interactions by the University of Iowa Community Engagement Corps with the community has helped the town and its community find solutions for the PCB contamination of the lagoon. In a recent study, Dr. Schnorr and his team found that pumpkin seedlings can break down a large amount of tetrabromobisphenol A, the most widely used brominated flame retardant, through a process called glycosylation. This has implication for cleaning up TBBPA in the future. In the interest of time, I will move quickly through the next few slides, encouraging you to download these slides to find more information about the SRP-funded bioremediation projects that are of interest to you. And reminder, our Superfund research program website is searchable. So I'm just going to zip through these. I'm really not going to go into them, but we have three investigators here who are looking at characterization of microbial communities. And I will highlight one of them a little bit because one of the issues is, you know, can something be done with regards to asbestos? And Brenda Casper from the University of Pennsylvania has come up with essentially a plant or a fungi that can be used to potentially bioremediation of asbestos-contaminated sites. I think that that is very good. This is why research is important. The next slide. Oh, here we go. Understanding mechanisms of absorption and bioavailability. We have three investigators here. One, Mark Brousseau from the University of Arizona. We will have two speakers from the University of Arizona today. talking about the issues with regards to bioavailability and remediation. The next slide focuses on measuring success of bioremediation. And these are all highly important, very specifically directed analytical and computational ways to be able to reduce exposure using remediation technologies. Again, look at each one of these technologies of interest to you, and it really is, these are really outstanding examples. Next slide is focuses on in situ biogeochemical factors impacting remediation. Again, there are three people that we're citing here. I'm not going to single anybody out, but I would also like to encourage you to revisit the webinar series that we just completed this spring, featuring five bioremediation research projects looking at how environmental contaminants are affected by complex biological, geological, and chemical processes. These researchers have made great strides in identifying optimal conditions to move bioremediation toward non-toxic endpoints, non-toxic endpoint products. Also, just as important, we learned about limiting factors. What characteristics of the environment can stall the bioremediation process? So these speakers were, and again, all this is archived. We have Upal Ghosh and Hanley Soo Kim from Duke. These were part of this whole activity that took place April 22nd and May to May 20th. And so I encourage you to look at that. So building on the webinar series we had in the spring, SRP wanted to take the opportunity to continue exploring future directions. One opportunity we foresee is to encourage crosstalk between bioremediation and human microbiome experts. NIHS has designated the microbiome as a key goal in its five-year strategic plan, which was initiated last year. As a multidisciplinary program, we encourage exchange of ideas between disciplines, and we see this as an excellent opportunity to build linkages between the work in our bioremediation portfolio and that of the human microbiome. Today's session, in particular, will touch on the microbiome connections. But microbiome is just one opportunity to expand the bioremediation toolbox, which is the overall theme of this webinar series. So we are encouraging all of our speakers, all of our presenters in this session to think big and share perspectives on future directions of bioremediation. And so you know about the other sessions, on October 3rd, this coming Thursday, we'll focus on advances in omics approaches, as these often offer tremendous potential for discovering better bioremediation systems. And the session on October 11th will highlight new and emerging tools to improve existing bioremediation, such as nanotechnology, novel field approaches, and machine learning. So the speakers today are James Teagee from Michigan State University's SRP Center will discuss the past and future microbiome science, which transcends habitats. Dr. Teagee will summarize what we have learned from the past in microbial ecology that helps us project the future, and then we'll speculate on that future and how it may impact and likely facilitate SRP relevant microbiome research. He will be followed by Dr. Raina Meyer and Dr. Paul Carini from the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program Center. They will discuss new integrative tools that combine plant transcriptomics, microbial metagenomics, and high throughput microbial culturing to link key taxa to specific arsenic biotransformations important to both phytoremediation processes and human health. It is a pleasure to have these leaders in the field on today's webinar, and I hope you will enjoy what they have to say. Our first speaker today is Dr. Jim Teege, a University Distinguished Professor of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics and of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences. He is also Director of the Center for Microbial Ecology at Michigan State University. His research focuses on microbial ecology, physiology, and diversity, especially regarding the nitrogen cycle, bioremediation of environmental pollutants, and the use of molecular methods to understand microbial community structure and function. His group has discovered several microbes that degrade chlorinated pollutants and is using genomics to better understand microbial functions in their environment. He has served as editor-in-chief of Applied and Environmental Microbiology and editor of Microbial and Molecular Biology Reviews. He has over 500 publications, including 7 in Science and Nature. He shared the 1992 Finley Prize from UNESCO for research contributions in microbiology of international significance. He is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Academy of Microbiology, and the Soil Science Society of America. And he is a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. He was president of the American Society for Microbiology and the International Society of Microbial Ecology. He received his Bachelor of Science degree from Iowa State University and his MS and PhD degrees from Cornell University. Jim, I will now turn it over to you, and thank you for doing this.
Okay, thank you, Bill. And it's a pleasure to have a chance to talk about the past and future of microbiome science. So, in this regard, I'm finding the slide advancer, which I just did. Okay. So, I'll begin with my view of the microbial world, which is has three dimensions of this sphere. One is the breadth of the microbial world, one is the depth, which is the extent we understand the microbes, and the third, which is the most relevant to this topic, is the interaction with the environment. So the breadth, according to Losi and Lennon's paper, is about 10 to the 12th species. We've defined about, or identified and characterized about 15,000. So of course, many unknown. But this represents the microbial world, and when we think about the microbiome, it is the extent of these organisms interacting with each other and the environment. The next slide shows how originally metagenomics has developed over the last decade. First, it was all about sequencing. I had a concern about the analysis of that sequence, but then we lead to the experimental phase, and that's where we are now. Sequencing is rather a commodity and not that expensive. The computational part is still a challenge, but now we're at the experimental part. And during this time period, it's been a shifting of the brand to the microbiome, focusing more on the community and the organismal basis of that genetic information. And if we move to what's happened in the past, so let me summarize the past first. So these are the eras in microbial ecology, and what I want to point out is they've basically been technology-enabled. So in the 60s and 70s, I was an undergraduate beginning in 1960, and the first work was about functions and processes. So it's about the biogeochemical cycles, nitrogen, sulfur, carbon, other elements. And the biodegradation also is a function and process and important that began to be important at that period of time. And we did that through incubations and with isolates. And we're using isotopes, and gas liquid chromatography became available, and autoanalyzers, so we could measure those functions and processes. But then with the 1980s came the PCs. And with the PCs, wow, we can do a lot more things quantitatively. So then came mathematical models and a strong emphasis on kinetics, because in all of these functions and processes, how fast they go and what controls them is based in kinetics. And I have a couple asterisks here, because this represents sort of my period in this time frame. So we published the first paper, which really described the first dehalogenation by microbes in science in 1982. That was a function and process that we studied from, or that we discovered from incubation. And we began by also looking at kinetics, what controls those processes. It's been 40 years since this first dechlorination, and now we've seen how far that has developed, which is quite impressive for organisms that are very difficult to manage. Then comes the 1990s, and we can sequence a gene. We can do DNA extraction. We can do hybridization. The 16S ribosomal gene became available as a marker, and they're first machine sequencers, and also the internet. So huge developments in the 90s on the technology side that enabled us to understand biology at its genetic level. Then comes the 2000s, and now it's not just genes, it's whole genome sequences. And we have high throughput sequencing, and we can actually assemble those gene fragments. And during that period, we had a key paper in 2006 in PNAS, which was still the best known PCB degrader, the Burkholderia area, which had a huge genome, the largest genome of a bacterium sequenced at that period of time. And from that, we learned a lot of information. For example, that organism has three different benzoate degrading pathways, all functional, and two different kinds of biochemistries to degrade those. So a huge amount of not only the forbenzoate, but other aromatic degrading capabilities in that organism. So showing the potential of certain organisms for doing a lot of work important to bioremediation. Then comes the 2010. So metagenomics, transcriptomics, proteomics, metabolomics. And we have even lower cost high throughput sequencing. And we have HPCs available. So that's the past, what we did in different eras, but the important point is how technology enabled us to do new things. So the big question is, what's the future? What's in the 2020s? And at the end, I'll talk something about my guesses for the future. So my themes are, we have lots of organismal and genetic diversity in nature, and many microbiologists on this phone probably recognize, or on this call probably recognize that already. And, of course, that's untapped, undiscovered, untapped. And then, as I've already pointed out, it's technology-enabled field, and what's next is the key point of this talk. And this is about microbiomes, and that means community-based activities, not looked so much at individual organism activities, but how communities work together and can be managed together for desired activities. So what about the genetic traits important to biodegradation? So I would list them this way. First is, one has to have the enzyme, the catalyst for a bioconversion. It may be a weak bioconversion, meaning that it's not optimized for that bioconversion, then there's a chance to improve that. Behind the bioconversion, a key point is the kinetics. How fast is that bioconversion? And that's a goal I'll come back to later. Then what about the regulation of that enzyme? The enzyme might be there, but it's not appropriately regulated, so we see the activity. can the substrate get into the cell? Is the permease appropriate for that? Many of these pollutants are non-water soluble, and detergent production then is the way microbes have dealt with this problem for hydrocarbons over millennia. Chemotaxis is important because it can move the organism to the pollutant. And then in an environmental setting, resistances to many other stresses become important, such as heavy metals, solvents, acidity, salt, heat. And finally, we may want organisms to attach so that they remain functional at their particular location, or we may not want them to attach so they disperse in the environment, like subsurface environments. So these are all genetic traits important to biodegradation, for which the genetic resources, the fundamental portion of them, probably exist in nature. And goal then in the microbiome science is to utilize those traits in a more effective way. Now, what about the diversity in nature? So this figure is soil samples from a transect across Kansas, Iowa, and Wisconsin. It happens to be from native prairie sites and matched 100-year cultivation sites with the goal of determining what's different between those two. And there's a little difference, but not a lot. The figure on the right side is the key one. That shows a rank order of phyllotypes from only 3 grams of soil from these various sites. And you see a structure there which shows that there are dominant organisms in those environmental samples, but there are also many that are more rare. So in a microbiome sense, we see a great range in frequency of organisms in particular communities. The Venn diagram on the left-hand shows in the center that about 50% of those phyllotype sequences are present in all samples. Some may be in large numbers, and some may be only one, but they are widely distributed. But of course, there are many unique to particular sites as well. So that's sort of an organismal level of diversity at small scales in the soil environment. If we go to the genetic level, which is the next slide, which addresses how diverse microbiomes are at the gene level. And this is work done by Costas Constantinidis at Georgia Tech, who came up with an algorithm called non-prial, which is a redundancy-based approach to assess diversity of sequence. Here it's presented in the sense of the amount of sequencing effort needed to completely sequence the members of those communities, those being AMD, is acid mine drainage, Jill Banfield's original work, the human intestinal tract, freshwater lakes, and soil. And the big point here is soil is the most diverse environment at a genetic level. And the next figure then takes that that approach steps farther using metagenomic data in databases. So this is 86 metagenomes, which have been evaluated using that approach to determine their genetic diversity. And across the bottom, you see the alpha diversity, not of organisms, but of genes. So one can get that kind of alpha diversity measure for gene types. And on the y-axis is the 16S sequence information that goes with that. And you see there is a relationship, so that's good. 16S does tell us something more than a taxonomic name. It tells us something about the genetic diversity. But a big point here is also the extent of that diversity. So I now take the pointer, and on this lower side, most of these are human samples. And then we move to marine and freshwater samples. And then these samples here on the right are soil samples going up to some that are extremely diverse up here. So again, the soil environment is the most diverse, and the extent of diversity is really high. Then moving on to the next slide, this is work done by out of the labs of Bill Hugenholtz and Gene Tyson in Brisbane in Australia, where they've taken public data from metagenomes and assembled organisms, and from that determine what's new. And so if we look up here in this upper right corner, you see they find 8,000 new genomes, 17 new bacterial phyla, and 3 new archaeal phyla, and at lower orders of taxonomy, also a number of new organisms. So it points out that with this sequence in Nature, we can characterize at the full genome level a number of different taxa, which then also potentially become our references for discovering new organisms. So again, working with Costas' group at Georgia Tech, he's come up with what we call the Microbial Genome Atlas. This was published last year in Nucleic Acid Research. But the idea here is to extend from 16S, which is good above the genus and above level, but not so good below that level, but to use then the rest of the genetic information to characterize at the levels below what can be characterized by 16S. And so this MIGA tool, which is available on Costas' website, one can then get this finer level of resolution from isolates, from these metagenome assembled genomes, or from single cell recovered sequences. And then what you can do is then analyze that at a finer level. And this is illustrated by his work with taking the genomes of Campylobacter junii, which is the pathogen. The reason the pathogens are the examples is because they have many more genomes sequenced. But it illustrates the point. This is one species. It has 95% average nucleotide identity, which has become sort of the species definition. But you can see then that there are 32 clades that can be recognized within this one species. So it provides this much finer level of resolution, as you see across here. So one can actually then characterize at a level below 16, what's resolvable by 16S. The other thing that can be done with this is to look at the pangenome of a particular species. And I call this the genetic image of a species. So the blue line at the top, at the bottom, are all genes that are found in common with the next genome sequence. So does that next genome have that gene? And you see then that the number is reduced to maybe 500 genes or in all, in this case, of Vibrio cholera. But the important point is the red at the top. Those are all the new genes found in the additional genome sequence. And that's what is the pangenome. And the important point here is that there's a lot of diversity then within species as we characterize them. That the next member of that species may not have, or it may have some different gene. So again, it emphasizes the point of genetic diversity. Okay, so that's about organisms and the genetic makeup. Now, how does that come together to establish a community and therefore a microbiome? So this is my simplistic view of assembly of a community. So what determines that community structure? Well, some of it is deterministic. In other words, there are features in that community that select for particular populations. And of course, the primary substrate is often a major one. If that is a chlorinated biodegradable aromatic, that will select chlorinated aromatic biodegraders. However, in a makeup of many communities, much can be stochastic, which is pure chance. And under this figure, then I put some other illustrating points. For example, the first would be the major drivers, like the primary substrates, primary electron acceptors, for example. But there can also be more subtle components, like temperature or salt, or components like that that may exert their existence, not depending on how dynamic the environment is, maybe not the first year, but after 10 years or after 100 years. There are also some components that are based on the physiological nature of the organism, such as spore formation or other starvation survival mechanisms, for which allow the organisms to exist in a community for a long period of time and may only occasionally be active or maybe not active at all. And then, of course, on the right-hand side is pure chance, stochastic. The big questions here are, what features are deterministic that determine the makeup of that community? How much of that community is made up by deterministic features? Maybe it's only 50%, and the other 50% is stochastic. Or how much of the unexplained is the unmeasured? Maybe there are deterministic features, but we just don't measure them. And I think that's often a problem, if we don't have the tools or the insight to measure what features might be deterministic for that community structure. This also raises the question of how uniform is the dispersal? Certainly, every genotype is not in every gram of soil. Therefore, dispersal is not uniform. So that is also a factor, is how uniform is the inoculation. And the last point in terms of community structure is that is system dynamics the primary determinant of this distribution? The answer, in my opinion, is yes. But what about degree of dynamics? In a fast-moving stream, an organism to be successful at any particular location has to have deterministic features, being able to grow at that particular location and probably rapidly and to attach or something like that. But in the subsurface of a soil, which is not very dynamic, then the community may have the deterministic factors may be a lesser extent. Okay, so now to give some examples from the past that sort of project towards the future about traits that are important for biodegradation. This is a protein tree of dioxygenase genes in which certain genes can be pointed out, and they correspond to phylogeny. So this is, I get my pointer again. Up here we have pH degraders, but these are in gram-negative organisms. Here are pH degraders, and these proteins are in gram-positive organisms. So these particular proteins, they may have some of the same general functions, but are in two different major taxonomic groups. These are the toluene and benzene degraders here. And these are other degraders, which ones with arrows pointing, ones that are dibenzofuran and dioxin degraders. And these are phthalate degraders over here. So some of these proteins correspond to their activities, but a big part that I want to point out in this particular image is the other half of this circle, which is other proteins that are dioxygenases that are either not characterized or some are of the benzoate family. But the big point is that a lot of other dioxygenases can be found in nature for which their substrate is not known. And this slide points out some of those sequences. These are amplicons based on the biphenyl dioxygenase gene derived from PCB studies. What is on the right-hand side here are clusters of those sequences that are in GenBank. So that's what's known. What's in yellow here are sequences that are in GenBank and are also found in a particular site. In other words, they match. So some of the sequences found match what's in GenBank. But the big point here on the right-hand side of this blue are clusters, or protein clusters of sequences of dioxygenases that are not in GenBank. And you see half of what is found in this particular site equals what's already in GenBank. So in one sample is as many dioxygenase sequences as in all of GenBank. And the bars then point out how many of those sequences, as an example. And the next figure is using that same approach with two different samples. One is from the Czech Republic at a heavily polluted site, and it was soil. And on the right-hand side are samples from the Passaic River in New Jersey, one of the sites that Gerben Zijlstra studies and is a Superfund site. The colors on the outside here, the yellow color, is if that sequence is in a reference sequence in GenBank. And you see at the New Jersey site, many of the sequences are in GenBank. But if we go to the Czech Republic side, many of the sequences are not in GenBank. The other colors are different clusters of sequences, and they are found at both sites. So 90% of them in New Jersey and in the Czech Republic are the same. It's just that in the Czech Republic, there are many, many more of those sequences than they are at the New Jersey site. So lots of protein families in common, of the dioxygenase families in common worldwide, but their distribution is quite different. The last technology example I wanted to mention is stable isotope probing, which I think has an important future now that the methodologies are getting even better for this approach. And this is where you use a label. In this case, we use C13 biphenyl because we're after the aromatic biphenyl type of degradating activity. But one can use N15. One can also use O18 for some different approaches. And so then growing the organisms on those particular substrates, then having a C13 labeled metagenome, which you can do a number of things with, and in this case, looking for novel function in cosmid libraries. So what we did here is found a novel biphenyl BPA and BPE dioxygenate. So if I take my arrow again, this line here is the clone that we identified in the Cosmid Library that had dioxygenase characteristics. These are the genes when we sequenced that we found, and here are the ones that were potentially active on PCBs. Now, so we sequenced that, and above here you see the sequence of the new clone, and you see LB400 sequence, and another sequence done by the Japanese that were and the key thing is these regions here, 1, 2, 3, and 4, which are determined substrate specificity. And you see there are differences in this new clone from the two previous most closely related dioxygenase clones. And then if we screen those for activity on these different PCB congeners you see here, you can see that in this new clone, there are some similarities, but there are also some differences from the previous clones. And they point this out as an example of a direction I think that is useful in the future of how to recover novel activities that can be important in biodegradation. And the last example that I'll point out is about kinetics. I said I would come back to kinetics because I think that is often a key aspect. And Bill pointed out in his talk that how fast there, that's one of the limitations in biodegradation is how fast. So here we looked at kinetics for 3-chlorobenzoate degradation. The reason chlorobenzoate is we wanted a substrate that is generally, organisms can generally found in most soil samples that degrade chlorobenzoate, but not a huge number of them. So therefore, we can see differences. And these are soil samples taken from undisturbed sites in two ecosystems. One is the Mediterranean ecosystem of Southwest Australia, South Africa, Central Valley of California, and Chile. And the other is the Taiga Forest ecosystem of Saskatchewan in Canada and Northeast Russia. And the isolates then that were shown to degrade 3-chlorobenzoate then are tested for their kinetic rates of degradation. So this is the amount of chlorobenzoate they degrade in a fixed period of time. And then the organisms are put in rank order. So that's what you see across the bottom is the rank order. So these are the slowest degraders of chlorobenzoate. And these are the fastest degraders of chlorobenzoate. And when we isolate organisms from nature, we usually study these because we study the ones that grow the fastest. My one point here is that we're studying the odd organisms in nature because we're only studying the fast growers. Many of the organisms in nature would be of these kinds here. And then if we take all of these different habitats and put them together, this is sort of a general profile of the rate of organisms in nature and their ability to degrade chlorobenzoate. But a key point here is that these fast degraders over here on the right-hand side degrade everything to CO2 and chloride primarily. This is the full amount of chloride released here. But these organisms in the intermediate stage are not doing complete degradation. They're producing chlorocatechol and some of a little bit of chloride. And these over here on the left-hand side are really slow degraders, not doing very well at all. But if you think about the organisms distributed in nature, many of them are these types here, and the ones in the middle would require a community to complete the degradation rapidly. Chlorocatechol being produced by the primary degrader could be degraded by another organism. So this illustrates the role for a community in a microbiome and the big role of kinetics in biodegradation. The last technology piece is about long-reach sequencing, which I think will be coming on pretty strong. In this case, it's about antibiotic resistance genes, not biodegradation genes, but there's some similarity because often both are plasmid-borne. In this case, we did sequencing of an environmental sample with both PacBio and Nanopore. And the big point here is that because of the long-reach sequencing, we can get full genes. So about 70% of the genes we identified, we had the full sequence. So that's an advantage of long-read sequencing, you get the full gene. The other point is these are the number of sequences with greater than 10 antibiotic resistance genes and mobile genetic elements. So you see a large number of those are showing the whole gene context, and in this case, their mobility. And this point then also relates a little bit to bioremediation, in that we're looking at what resistance genes are on mobile elements from that long-read sequencing. And the blue bar here is the sequence contains a antibiotic resistance genes on a mobile element. And this is the sequence contains a resistance gene. So most of the metal resistance genes have associated with mobile elements, and these are multi-drug biocide, for example, and these are antibiotic resistance genes. But the big point here is that getting the entire gene and what genes are linked with them and if they're on mobile elements is an important goal in general for understanding microbial ecology. So to close then, what about the future? So this is what I project for our science in the next 5 years, that we will return to the questions of the 70s and 80s, which are those process measures. So we will do those kind of measures, we'll do modeling, and we'll do more culture-based resolution, and I think you'll hear more about that, but with more resolving methodologies. So we had the questions right earlier, we didn't have the methodologies. Next, then, we'll do more hypothesis-driven microbiome science, sort of back to my original figure, and that will deal with questions about ecology, which is very important about remediation because we want the organisms to succeed in that environment, evolution, function, mechanism. We'll do long-read sequencing, and that'll become a technology standard. We'll use advanced microscopies, so we'll understand more at the organism scale. So we'll understand that environment that the organism is in. We'll do more image analysis because that's something that we can computationally analyze quickly. My gosh, if we can do everybody's facial recognition until where they are most of the time, we can certainly do microbes as well. More use of isotope methods because those are important to link the function. Better habitat characterization so we can get more of those deterministic features. We'll do more single cell amplified genomes and metagenome amplified genomes. And we'll use whole genome information, not just 16S for taxonomy. And we'll hopefully analyze a lot of the diversity information we've had over the past decade. And then the longer term for the future, maybe over the next 20 years, the big question is, what are the big game changers? And I don't know what those are. But I think we'll do more in-field rapid e-connected diagnostics with AI guidance, which certainly can help in site assessment and progress of bioremediation. We can do image analysis. We can do enhanced metabolite and chemical analysis and all kinds of multiple omic markers. AI, machine learning, deep learning, neural networks have become standard. I think you're going to hear more about those, too. And if any of these that I think will have the biggest impact over the next 5 to 10 years, I think this one will. I think my first paper using neural networks was more than 10 years ago now, but the limitation in the past is not enough data to really make this work well. We'll have that data in the future, and we'll have the technologies to analyze it. High-throughput culturing and the ecological, physiological, and biochemical characterization. DNA markers for kinetic properties, why not? Kinetics are so important, we'll have those markers so we can determine kinetic traits. High-throughput direct protein sequencing. Real-time e-connected omics with function. CRISPR-Cas directed microbial design. Particular microbiome management and ownership. That's particularly relevant to bioremediation. Synthetic ecobiology and designer communities, and then probably eventually quantum computing, because we have complex systems, and that's what that's designed for. So that's my predictions, the longer-term predictions for the future. And we know how poor those kind of predictions can be. We know that Bill Gates said nobody would need more than 364K, and that Tom Watson, the founder of IBM, said the world would need no more than 5 computers, and those guys were successful. So predicting the future is hard, but it's better we try because it helps us to be prepared for the future. That's my point. So now I can turn it back to
Heather. I'll be taking over from here.
Okay.
Thank you, Jim. What a wonderful presentation. Great overview of where the field has come from the time that you were getting started and to where we are now. We're not going to place bets on your future predictions, so needn't worry about that. But certainly appreciate how your ideas help us think outside the box and test the limits of where we are now. We do have a few questions, and we will also want to be sure to have time for our second set of speakers too, but let's take one or two, Jim, if that's okay. We had one come in. Is bioremediation field working with the health research teams looking into the use of AI and machine learning to determine the impacts of multiple pollutants on our environment?
That's certainly an appropriate question. I don't know whether who's doing that, but I would think someone would be. I think a lot of these technologies, whether it's AI or the omics, are cross-field technologies that can be applied to the human microbiome or human toxicology as well as environmental. Actually, I would say that the early research that I pointed out that we did with the novel dioxygenase genes led us to be invited to one of the be a partner in one of the big human microbiome projects to look at particular functions in the intestinal tract of people with colitis.
Great. And along those lines, you just mentioned the novel dioxygenase gene. And wanted to ask, this is in the context of your isotope studies, and wanted to ask what would be the next steps involved in moving this discovery into application?
So more high throughput evaluation of that diversity so that one is not dealing with well, in this case, we had a large number of clones, but you need even a larger number of clones and more efficient ways to screen for the novelty. But once you have the novelty, then the next steps are not, the next laboratory steps are not too difficult. They still require moving it to the field and what makes that organism successful in the field. If you had an organism that was extremely adapted to a particular environment, had the appropriate resistances, and was a very kinetically very effective, then you would have an organism or a set of organisms. I generally tend to think that it's the microbiome, in other words, a set of organisms,
mm-hmm.
rather than just one, that would be the most effective way to move it to the field.
Excellent. And here's a good one. Can gene sequences inform about enzyme kinetics?
So that's been what I think is what I think is an important goal for the future. I've promoted mm-hmm. this for a while, but it's a ways off. There are a few examples in the literature where people have related sequence to activities or to kinetics, but it's a ways off because one has to know more about the protein structure and how it relates to the kinetics, and then know what that what those particular markers are that correspond to rapid kinetics. But I think so. That may be a 20-year goal, but I think we'll get there because kinetics is also a gene-coded trait.
Right, and we see where you're calling for that to really come back into vogue, calling for investigators out there to be looking more into that, and that's certainly one opportunity. Well, thank you, Jim. If you would stay on the line with us for Raina and Raina's presentation, we will go back to you and answer any other questions that have come up that we didn't have time for.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I took longer than I thought I would.
Well, I think we got off to a little late start as well. So, but we really appreciate the breadth of what you presented to us, and it is a challenge to get it all in a short period of time. And probably our next speakers both Raina and Paul are going to have a similar challenge. But in any case, without further ado, I would like to introduce our next set of speakers. And we're pleased that from probably very warm Arizona, Dr. Raina Mayer is a professor of soil, water, and environmental science at the University of Arizona. She is the director of the NIEHS Superfund research program there. It's focused on understanding the health impacts of remediation of mine sites. She's also the interim director of the University of Arizona Institute of the Environment, which seeks more broadly to advance innovative solutions to the global environmental challenges facing society. The Mayer Lab seeks to understand how they can exploit the soil microbiome and its activities and products to promote bioremediation processes and benefit human health. A major focus is examination of relationships between soil microbial function and diversity and the productivity of disturbed and marginal terrestrial ecosystems with a focus on mining waste and arid desert ecosystems. Dr. Paul Carini will also be speaking. He is an assistant professor of soil subsurface microbiology, soil, water, and environmental science at U of Arizona. The Carini Lab is focused on understanding how microbes help make Earth habitable for humans. This view leads us to a diverse set of questions, both in terrestrial and aquatic environments, with the goal of understanding how microbial communities transform important nutrients, remove pollutants, affect soil fertility, and influence aquatic productivity. By studying the growth of microbial cultures, their genome sequences, and their environmental distributions, the research team designs experiments that help uncover new and unusual biogeochemical cycles and provide hypothesis-based explanations for long-standing geochemical observations. So Raina and Paul, I will now turn it over to you.
Thanks, Heather. Can you hear us all right?
Yes, you sound coming through loud and clear.
Great. Well, first I'd like to thank Jim Teagee for a wonderful overview of the technologies and tools that have been available and hopefully will become available. And then I'd like to thank NIEHS for organizing this webinar and inviting Paul and I to participate. My name is Raina Mayer. I'm going to lead off and talk about a more specific project, how we have used the microbiome tools over the last decade to understand plant-microbe-metal interactions in soil systems, particularly for the remediation of mine waste sites. Arsenic is one of the more mobile and bioavailable metals in these systems, and so it has been a focus, but we generally measure a suite of 20 or more metals in our samples. One focus of our work has been the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter Superfund site, seen in this slide. Look at the upper left-hand photo. This site was mined from the early 1900s to 1969 and then abandoned, leaving a large mine tailings pile that is highly acidic, pH 2 to 3, and with enormous metal content, arsenic, zinc, and lead ranging up to 4,000 milligrams per kilogram each. Since the site was abandoned, no plants have grown or even encroached on the tailings due to the low pH and high metal content. Almost every morning, there are high winds in the area which generate dust clouds from the tailings. You can look at the upper right-hand photo. And this dust moves across the highway into the neighboring town, carrying with it toxic metals. And you can see the town in the bottom photo on the right-hand side. This site was listed as a Superfund site in 2008, which is when we started working on it. And our goal was to establish a plant cover, and you can actually see our field trial right here on the middle of the top of the tailings, and determine how that cover could impact dust generation and metal bioavailability. Since plants don't grow in the tailings, we examined a number of amendments to the tailings with a focus on compost and the rates of compost needed for robust plant establishment and survival. Briefly, we were able to show that plants established in the compost-amended tailings not only reduced dust generation, but actually removed metal-containing particulates from air passing through that vegetation. Further, using synchrotron-based tools over in the lower left-hand side photo, we were able to show that phytoremediation did not increase bioavailability of arsenic as we had predicted, but actually caused sequestration of arsenic on plant roots in neoformed, less labile arsenic forms. Over the past 10 years, we have extensively analyzed the mine tailings microbiome using small subunit amplicon analysis for bacteria, archaea, and fungi, as well as real-time PCR analysis of key functional nitrogen cycling genes, both in greenhouse and field studies. We have combined these data with various biogeochemical analyses to show first that key microbial populations associated with pH transitions indicate either sustained future plant growth or indicate acid generation conditions that will inhibit further plant growth. Secondly, we've shown that these key indicators can be used to manage field sites and indicate the need for example, reapplication of compost in regions that are susceptible to reacidification to maintain beneficial bacterial communities for long-term plant establishment. This work showed that there were vastly different microbiomes in the field trial as a function of both plant health status, tailings pH, and in the bulk tailings versus rhizosphere-influenced tailings. And these findings led us to become very interested in the relationship between the rhizosphere microbiome and plant gene expression. And this will be the focus of the remainder of my talk. We are working in collaboration with Dr. Julian Schroeder, who will be talking later in this bioremediation series. He is a plant biologist at the University of California, San Diego Superfund Research Program. And this work was supported through a KC Donnelly Exchange awarded to microbiologist Dr. Priyanka Kushwaha from my research program. What I will focus on today is a tool that we are developing that combines microbiome and biogeochemical analyses with plant metatranscriptomics. The data I'm going to show have just been generated last week by Priyanka during a visit to UC San Diego. They're not yet published, but they show the potential for this tool to provide insight to the phytoremediation process and the way that both microbes and plants deal with arsenic. Priyanka set up a greenhouse study in the Iron King tailings. Recall that plants do not grow in these tailings alone, but we have found that compost amendment does allow plant growth. So the treatments that Priyanka set up were 10, 15, and 20% compost amendment by weight, and a potting soil control. The plant used in the study was quail bush, which has been successful in field trials. It's a native plant, and it is both drought and salt tolerant. The plants were grown for several months in the greenhouse and then harvested. Root and shoot tissue samples were sent to UC San Diego for metatranscriptomic analysis. And amplicon sequencing was performed at the University of Arizona on bulk and rhizosphere-influenced soil samples. This slide shows the bacterial and archaeal richness and diversity as a function of compost amendment. So if you look at the figure on the left, this is richness, and the pink is the 10% compost treatment, the green is the 15%, and the blue is the 20% compost treatment. The circular symbols are representing bulk samples, and the triangle symbols represent rhizosphere-influenced samples. Increased compost amendment is associated with increased richness, so you can draw a diagonal line here. There's no difference between bulk and rhizosphere samples except for the 10% treatment, which had lower richness in the bulk tailing. And data diversity on the right showed a similar pattern. This slide shows the plant transcript analysis for root samples from the 10 and 20% compost treatment. There were a total of 160,000 transcripts assembled, and for the root samples from the 10 and 20% treatment, which is what is shown here, there were 145 transcripts that were significantly differentially expressed at greater than logfold, 8 logfold difference. Since there is no genome sequence for quail bush, these transcripts were matched to Arabidopsis gene, and of the 145 transcripts, 62 matched to Arabidopsis gene. This slide shows 37 genes, 24 that are upregulated in the 10% compost treatment. So that's shown here on the right, and 13 that are upregulated in the 20% compost treatment on the left. The bright red, I should say, is downregulation, and the bright blue is most upregulated. So again, these data were generated just last week, so we have not had a lot of time to examine them yet, but we do call out a few genes here on the right side that are involved in DNA repair, adaptation to salt stress or abiotic stress in general, and in the protection of nucleic acids from oxidative stress. What is really exciting about this collaboration, though, is that we now have the ability to combine these data sets and search for relationships between the microbiome and plant gene expression. This slide shows the relationships between the plant root genes and the microbiome in bulk soil. So this is the bulk soil. The figure on the left is the 10% treatment, and the figure on the right is the 20% treatment. As before, the plant genes are on the y-axis, and the x-axis represents microbial taxa. Similar to what was done to choose the plant genes we've been discussing, the microbial taxa were chosen based on those that were differentially abundant between the 10 and 20% compost treatment at a log-fold change greater than 8. A Spearman correlation analysis was performed, and in this case, there's not a lot of difference that you see in the relationship between the microbial taxa and the plant genes. But if you look at this slide, which looks at, it's the same analysis performed on the plant root genes, but now we're looking at the microbiome in the rhizosphere-influenced soil, there's a different story. In the 10% treatment on the left side, there are three taxa that have little relationship with plant gene expression, so the ones without color, the columns without color. 5 taxa downregulated in red most of the plant genes, and 3 taxa upregulated most of the plant genes. These are the blue columns. So it appears that there are microbial populations in the vicinity of the root that influence plant gene expression. In summary, combining environmental microbiome analysis, whether the environment is soil or water or a human gut, with host metatranscriptomics, whether the host is a plant or a human, is a relatively new approach. We have found just a very few papers that have been published that have used it, and those are cited here in the slide. As a tool for the mining site work that we are doing, combining microbiome analysis of rhizosphere-influenced soil with plant gene expression shows great promise to identify the key microbes that are important for plant establishment and survival. And I'm going to come back to this point in a moment, but I want to take the time to give a shout out to how NIEHS is investing in long-term studies and pushing collaboration among its centers. Speaking from the perspective of remediation research, it can take a decade or more to develop new remediation technologies in the lab and then take promising results to the field. Our studies have certainly benefited from this type of long-term investment. So the next step is to go beyond identification of the taxa involved and actually culture these microbes to allow study of mechanisms of the plant microbe metal interactions. And my colleague Paul Carini is going to take over now and discuss high throughput cultivation for just this purpose.
Thank you, Raina. My name is Paul Carini. I'm here at the University of Arizona in the Department of Environmental Science. And I'm going to talk to you today about some of the approaches that our lab has been using and developed for high throughput cultivation and screening of natural and host associated microbial populations, and to understand how these microbes can be used in remediation or metabolism, altering potentially metabolism in host organisms. Just a brief outline of what I'll be talking about. I'll be noting why it's probably more important now than it ever has been to culture microbes as a way to anchor microbiome data and metagenome data that's being collected at an astronomical pace. We'll be transitioning to some of the approaches that our lab is using and developing to get many microbial taxa in the culture. We'll talk briefly about what I believe is the new bottleneck and potentially one of the areas for novel approaches in screening all of these cultures. So if we have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of cultures, how do we begin to identify the ones that we're interested in? And then how we're potentially going to use these microbial cultures to construct synthetic communities that can be used to understand host-microbe interactions as it pertains to contamination and as part of our Superfund renewal project. I want to highlight that all of these approaches are really ecosystem agnostic, so we could use these in a variety of different settings or contexts. They're not specific to a particular problem or question, and they're very adaptable. So after a decade and a half of high throughput sequencing, we now have a pretty good idea that the microbial biosphere is enormous. We continue to find extended depth in the microbial biosphere, and most of these microbes are completely unknown in the context of their activities, what they're doing in the environment, and how to culture them. Most of these microbes in complex systems like soil are uncultured, so we're really limited in our knowledge of what their activities are or what their potential is in bioremediation. So for us to fill some of those gaps, the classic approach would be to culture these microbes either in an enrichment with other microbes or in pure culture to study them in the lab and get an idea of how exactly they're performing their functions or taking part in particular functions in the environment. Work in host-associated fields has shown that a very good portion of the microbiome in different host-associated systems is culturable. So the argument that we can't culture these and therefore we should sequence them, at least in host systems, is a little bit limited. There are three recent papers that have been published, one in the human gut, one in the mouse gut, and one in the Arabidopsis rhizosphere, that shows that the majority of microbes and microbial functions that have been detected with molecular tools can be cultured in the lab. And in each of these systems, these microbial cultures are being used to really disentangle complex relationships between the host and the microbiome. However, as Dr. Teaching noted, this is a different story in soil. This is a publication out of Noah Feuer's lab showing that of the abundant and ubiquitous soil microbes, only about half of them have a cultured representative in the history of microbiology. That's only the abundant and ubiquitous microbes. There's a long tail of diversity that are not abundant nor ubiquitous. They're very much site-specific, and most of those have not yet been cultured. One of the driving questions in my lab group is to try and understand how can we access this uncultured biodiversity to identify taxa that play key roles in bioremediation through cultivation-based approaches. So I've spent the little bit of time that our lab has been here at Arizona developing and using high-throughput cultivation approaches. We want to ultimately understand how do we construct culture libraries that can be screened for properties of interest with high throughput. And then can we grow uncultured lineages in soil in particular, but we do things in other environments as well, using some of these new approaches. So if we have high throughput, we have the opportunity to alter environments relatively quickly, alter culture conditions relatively quickly to get new taxa into culture. So the three approaches we use a fairly standard solid media approach, and I'll describe that in a moment. We also try and target slow-growing microbes that are usually out-competed on petri plates called oligotrophs. Typically, they grow with low nutrient concentration. We have a special approach for them. And then we have what we're working with a private company to help develop an ultra-high-throughput cultivation approach that will really take culturing to the next level of throughput, to the point where it can be comparable to some of the high-throughput culturing sequencing technologies, rather. So our first approach is a fairly standard approach. Our goal with all of these approaches is to work with small volumes that can be arrayed pretty rapidly and stored with low amounts of freezer space. So we do a classic microbiome culturing approach, just doing pore plates or spreading our inoculum onto the surface of petri plates, and we incubate them for some amount of time until colonies grow. Most microbiologists are familiar with this approach. Then we manually pick those colonies and array them into 96 well plates that contain growth medium. We can also use robots to do this as well. It's not quite as accurate. The fidelity is not quite as great. Robots can't see some things that humans can see, believe it or not. And we array those into 96 well plates that have growth medium. We incubate those a second time and then cryopreserve an aliquot of that culture medium. And we do that without really knowing what's in that plate, so we immediately preserve that biodiversity. And we have ways to track which microbes or which plates end up in which freezer stock. Then we screen the rest of these for our property of interest, and we'll talk about screening in a few slides. So this is a fairly standard approach. This is best for microbes that grow well on petri plates, and we know ahead of time that these microbes grow well on petri plates. But as many people understand and know, not everything grows on a petri plate. There are numerous reasons why things won't grow on petri plates. So we've sort of developed some alternative strategies specific to soil, or we've modified existing strategies to be used in soil. One of the approaches that we've modified is the dilution to extinction approach that is widely used in aquatic microbiology to isolate cells that are abundant in nature but don't grow well on petri plates. My graduate student Joy Custer and postdoc Ryan Bartleme are working on this project. The workflow for this is we separate cells from our environmental matrix, in this case soil. We count those cells with flow cytometry to get an accurate number of cells per unit volume. And then we dilute those cells into growth medium in 96 well plates. So on average, there's about 1 to 5 cells in every well of this 96 well plate. We hope that one of those cells is viable, will germinate into a pure culture in that plate. After incubating this for a certain amount of time, sometimes a week we'll do it, and other times we incubate for a month or longer. We transfer those, or we screen these microbes with high-throughput flow cytometry, as indicated here, to identify which wells have exhibited growth. And then we rearray the microbes that are growing from those 96 well plates into plates that we can cryopreserve, and then we rearray a fraction of those so we can screen them for a function of interest. As I mentioned before, this is good for microbes that only grow on low nutrient media called oligotrophs. This is where flow cytometry is integral. Many of these microbes grow below the detection limits of optical density. It's also good for microbes that don't like being crowded out by faster growing microbes on a petri plate. Similar to this, we are working in collaboration with a private company, General Automation Lab Technologies, abbreviated GALT, G-A-L-T here, to develop a device that is what we would call an ultra-high throughput cultivation methodology. Similar to our previous dilution to extinction, we separate cells from an environmental matrix. We dilute those cells into growth medium that contains a fluorometric growth indicator. And we spread those dilutions onto this microchip. This chip here is about the size of a microscope slide, and it has 6,000 3.4 nanoliter wells engraved on it. And you can kind of see the engraved part right here on the slide. The idea here is to get one to several cells in each well. We seal this chip and then incubate it. And then this GALT prospector unit, which is now available for purchase through GALT, screens this chip based on growth of that flora, based on a color change with that fluorometric growth indicator. It's placed right here in the chip. The machine detects the positive fluorescence, and onboard robotics on this machine then manually picks these wells, or automatically picks these wells, and arrays them into 96 well plates that contains growth medium. After a second incubation, we cryopreserve an aliquot of those 96 well plates and screen the cultures for a function of interest. This is best for rapidly growing cultures. At the moment, it's best for rapidly growing cultures, things that you would find in the rhizosphere and potentially contaminated sites as well. Once you have all these microbes, what do you do with them? We have lots and lots and lots of cultures, and we're working through identifying interesting microbes of or microbes of interest, I guess. And it really depends what you want to do with them. Screening cultures, if you're interested in identifying novel biodiversity, high throughput sequencing can be used to identify what you've grown in all of those plates. There are ways to make that high throughput sequencing efficient to identify taxa of interest. You can also do functional screens using PCR. So if you have a dozen 96 well plates and you're interested in identifying the nitrogen fixers in that example, you can do a PCR for NIFH, for example. If you're interested in identifying bioremediating microbes, you might look for a dioxinase gene or a phenylhydroxylase or something like that. And this could be as easy as presence, absence of that gene, or it could be you actually go through and sequence those genes to identify which microbes have which gene. And then finally, something that we're doing a lot of nowadays are colorimetric or fluorometric assays to find functions of interest. And the example that I use is that, for example, there's a colorimetric fluoride assay that can be used on plate readers, and we can detect the production of fluoride from an organofluoride compound, for example, to measure microbes that are capable of defluorination. Just as an example, and really I think there's a lot of room for development in this realm to identify novel bioremediating microbes. So we've included some of the approaches and concepts that we described here in our Superfund renewal project, which is investigating how gut microbes and mice metabolize inorganic arsenic. The concepts that we've kind of proposed, first of all, we'll get a lot of cultures using high throughput culturing techniques, but we can also use the concepts between high throughput, the concepts developed through these high throughput culturing techniques to develop synthetic communities, and we can treat those similar to the other cultures and develop novel screening methods for those synthetic communities. So in this example, we've isolated maybe 100 novel microbes or not so novel microbes from mouse gut communities, We combine them in various assorted synthetic communities that have different constituents and quantify how those synthetic communities biotransform or sequester inorganic arsenic in culture conditions. We can do that by measuring the conversion of arsenic 3 to different arsenic containing compounds, or we can measure the amount of arsenic that is sequestered into the microbial biomass. We do this for enough synthetic communities that, again, we're going to define ahead of time who's in each community. We can conduct correlation analysis of the different constituents, of the different biotransformations that these communities are responsible for, and identify functional guilds or clusters of synthetic communities that perform similar activities. In this case, we're proposing to build a correlation network from these data down here to identify strong and correlated arsenic transformation sequestration profiles. And then we will identify ones that may be beneficial to a host. For example, functional guild one here might be microbes that reduce the toxicity of arsenic to the given host. Functional guild two may be a community or a set of synthetic communities that help sequester arsenic so that the host never sees that arsenic, and so on and so forth. A similar approach could be used at a contaminated site to identify mixtures or combinations of microbes that may be relevant in remediating arsenic or any other potential contaminant. So in closing, I just want to show how new approaches and higher throughput approaches can help shift the bottleneck from getting novel microbes into culture to figuring out unique or interesting ways to screen these cultures for the activities of interest. And I want to highlight again that we can use these approaches and this sort of conceptual framework in multiple communities and to answer multiple questions, everything from soil bioremediation to host-gut microbe interaction. So with that, we'll hand it off to Heather.
Thank you, Raina and Paul. This is a really great overview of the work that University of Arizona has been doing over the period of time with the community at the Iron King site. Excellent to see the progress and all the phyto cover that you've been able to maintain. But then also good to see how you're digging deeper into what the microbial community is doing, their function, and then also looking forward to new approaches that can be applied there. So thank you very much for that overview. At this time, we have time for questions for you two, Raina and Paul, and so I'll just start reading some of the ones that came in from online. How much has the present land cover with your phytostabilization plants reduced dust and wind propagation of toxicants to the community? And how much do you think the microbiome is estimated to help?
So we have not covered the entire land surface of the tailings, but we have been able to make measurements across the planted plots. And those measurements show that not only do the plants that are in place preclude dust generation from the tailings that they're growing in, but they also capture particulates that are blowing from unplanted regions on the tailings. And when those particulates move through the vegetation, the leaves actually, or the particulates actually stick to the leaves and remove them from the air. I put our publication on the slide so you can actually look that up. And as to the role of the microbiome, I think it's extremely important. That's why I'm very excited about the collaboration with UC San Diego. If we can understand how particular microbial isolates or populations impact plant growth and plant sequestration of metals like arsenic, we can improve the remediation process. And I think may even be able to reduce the amendments that we add to the site, which is the largest cost of the remediation.
Great, and even just as a plug for the work that you are doing with University of California, San Diego, that Julian Schroeder, who was your partner in this project that you were talking about, will be speaking on Thursday, October 3rd, at our next seminar. So we hope people will tune in for that. And after that little commercial, I'll go to another question. So very interesting talk. How do we move from assessing synthetic communities for degradation potential to then looking at the communities already existing at a remediation sites and their remediation potential based on their community structure?
That's a really good question. So what synthetic communities, in my opinion, are most useful for is understanding how those microbes are interacting together. Because it's a synthetic community, we can perturb it and understand exactly which genes are involved, how those microbes are stabilizing the contaminant. There was a really nice paper describing facilitation of contaminant remediating microbes in metalworking fluid that was published, I think, a few months ago in PNAS, and they really get into how these microbes are benefiting and facilitating each other. So it's sort of a more mechanistic understanding from laboratory experiments. We can then start to have an idea of what to look for in a natural community to understand what's stabilizing the community, what might be perturbing the community. And a lot of that work can be done through genomics. I don't necessarily think that we need to have more functional data than that. We can sort of take what we learn in the lab and interpret it in the context of the broader community.
Great, thanks. And we did get several questions that are very specific to one or the other presenter today. And I think for those very specific questions, we will follow up with the investigators themselves and connect them to the questioner. But wanted to go ahead and open up the floor for questions that pertain to both of the presentations. And this next question was, I think, inspired by something on one of Dr. Chigi's slides, and that was the platform, the influence of platform. And so I think in one of your slides, you compared several different studies, the results from several different studies, and one of the variables was the platform that was used for the assessment. So the question is, did you find that there were any learning experiences from looking at the platform or the variation from platform? And this might be something that Raina and Paul can also address, but
this was for me, right?
Jim, right, Jim, if that's something that you can
The example I gave was with the PacBio in Nanopore, and in general, the results were the same.
Okay.
So I was surprised at that.
And can you remind us which platforms were used, if you recall?
This is for the long read sequence. So it was PacBio and Nanopore.
Okay.
Oxford Nanopore. Now, with regard to the, I think most of the other sequencing now is done by Illumina. So that's one platform. There are different versions of Illumina. But now some of the software tools can do a pretty good job of taking out those platform influences.
Okay.
We also did some sequencing of other technologies earlier that had more error rate. But I don't think right now the platform, for most things that I've been interested in, the platform hasn't been a big problem.
Okay. And I'm just wondering,
software to analyze the data.
Mm-hmm.
That neutralize that effect.
And Paul and Raina, did you have any assessment of that as well?
No, not really anything to add. Each platform has advantages and disadvantages, and it's what's available for your use, what you have access to.
Great, and Paul, a question about the screening aspect. You're coming about this from an arsenic perspective. If you're talking about screening for functionality such as being able to degrade a particular compound, is there another approach that is being adopted as part of these high throughput strategies, such as leaving that contaminant as a substrate to see if there's growth in that cell?
If I understand the question, it's can we select for microbes that are specifically growing on a contaminant? Yeah, the answer is yes. So there are a lot of considerations when it comes to growth medium design that can help streamline this process even further. So if you imagine there's 100,000 organisms in a gram of soil, but only 0.1% of those grow on some contaminant, you can design a growth media to select for that. And when you do some of the dilution to extinction type experiments, you would over-inoculate those wells. So on average, there's a couple hundred cells in each well. And the assumption would be that most of them don't grow, but the one, the diamond in the rough, so to speak, will grow on that well, and you'll be able to detect growth. So yeah, there's a lot of creativity when it comes to developing these high-throughput cultivation growth media that can really facilitate getting target organisms of interest, if I understood that correctly.
So if I can make a comment on that, a colleague we worked with in chemistry a while ago was able to link fluorescent compounds to different substrates and then measure that whether that fluorescent compound was released or not.
Yeah. That's another great way of doing it. And there's now I think there are even more unique ways to link fluorescent compounds, indicator compounds, to organic molecules. So there's definitely room for optimization.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And there was another question that, again, I think either one of your and either one of our presenters could answer, but what role does radioactivity, alpha, beta, and gamma, both norm and human-introduced radionuclides, have on enhancing or degrading microbiochemical processes? And again, either set of presenters is welcome to answer this one.
Heather, can you repeat that? You cut out a little bit in the middle.
I am competing with some road noise here. I apologize.
Yeah.
What does radioactivity, alpha, beta, gamma, whether it's norm or human-introduced radionuclides, what role do they have on enhancing or degrading microbiochemical processes?
Interesting. So, I mean, the big example that comes to mind are the national labs that have some big radionuclide problems with highly active species. And certainly, radioactivity in those environments will influence the type of microorganisms that can survive, and hence the activities that are present. But I think that for apart from the national lab, if you're considering soil systems, I don't think that radioactivity is a large problem.
Yes, I would agree.
And so that it does not reduce microbial biodegradation processes. And I guess plant-based as well. Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Unless the amount is really high. I mean, most microbes have a lot of DNA repair mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
So if it damages some DNA, they repair it. So it takes a larger amount to... we at one time evaluated ionizing radiation and UV radiation on effect on microbes. And it takes a large amount to really damage most microbes because they're DNA repair.
Great. I think that's a good answer. That helps understand the mechanism, too, for why they're so tolerant.
Right.
Okay, well, we are now coming to the point where I need to, unfortunately, start reading through our sign-off housekeeping. But I definitely want to thank our speakers today, Jim Teagee, Raina Mayer, Paul Carini. Very much enjoyed your presentation. Thank you for being willing to take on the task of bridging between microbiome and environmental microbiome research. We think there's a lot of opportunity here. And thank you for being willing to take a stab at this idea. And I want to thank you too. Cook.
This is an exciting area. This is something that the program has been involved in for a very long time. So I want to thank you all for doing this, and I look forward to hearing the other presentations on Thursday in the next couple of weeks. Thank you all.
Great, and that's a great way to cue us up for what I wanted to tell you about is that we do have lots of information that these current presenters have presented, have made available for you, and we'd like for you to therefore be sure to look at the related URLs pod, which contains all the seminar resources as well as seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to you to today's webinar. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive along with the soundtrack. So in the near future, we'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also in the related URLs, you'll find a seminar feedback form. We ask you to consider please filling that out, and we'll look at your comments and take into account as we develop additional our next webinar series. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. And staying connected, I would like to let the participants know the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. Several are listed here. The EPA's CLUIN webinars are at cluin.org. We are very thankful for the partnership we have with the EPA in allowing us to bring some of our research to a broader community through the CLUIN network. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter, TechDirect, and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We also encourage you to visit the SRP Risky Learning webpage for more information about upcoming sessions, as well as SRP on Twitter. And the other thing is that we want you to be able to sign up to receive emails directly from us about upcoming Risky Learning, or our monthly research briefs, which feature a particular hot publication that comes out of our research program. All you need to do is email us at srpinfo@mail.nih.gov, and we will add you to those lists, and we would be happy to do that. Okay, and then if we can move to our next slide. We thought we'd be incredibly remiss if we didn't mention all of the work that SRP is doing in microbiome research. So in similar fashion, where Dr. Sook was posted some slides for you to hopefully go back and reference when you have more time, we did want to show you a little slide here that shows some of the research that we're doing in microbiome, gives you an idea of the breadth and diversity there. We have about 22 SRP centers, and over a third of them are examining the role of human microbiome in xenobiotic interactions. So they're really forging ahead in that field. I encourage you to have a look at the seminar's resources page, as we have posted a list of these projects as well as recent publications for that. And also looking forward, we encourage you to join us on October 3rd, that's this Thursday, and the 11th, which is next Friday, both at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for the second and third sessions of this series. The second session will focus on advances in omics approaches, as these offer tremendous potential for discovering better bioremediation systems. We will hear from Dr. Claudia Gunch at Duke University. I think we're going to hear a little bit about fungi, which is a nice addition to a lot of the discussion about bacteria and archaea and plants today. Dr. Gunch is from Duke University. And also we heard mention of Dr. Julian Schroeder, some of the work that he's been doing with RANA, but he's also going to delve a little bit further into the work that he's specifically doing there at the University of California in San Diego. And then our third session will highlight new and emerging tools to improve existing bioremediation, such as nanotechnology, novel field approaches, and, as we heard a couple times today, machine learning. We will hear from Dr. Pedro Alvarez at Rice University, Dora Taggart from the SRP-funded Small Business Microbial Insights, and Amin Razavi, who is also from an SRP-funded Small Business Microbi Biotechnology. If you would like to join the webinars, you can register now. If you cannot attend, archives will be made available after the event. So we encourage you to come back to these pages for links to the archives after the webinars are held. And with that, it's time to conclude today's webinar. If you've submitted an online question that we did not have time to get to, or if it was very specific to one of the investigators, we will pass that on to the presenters, who can then follow up with you. If you have any additional questions, you can also contact the presenters.